This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. According to official government estimates, military operations in Iraq now cost about $12.5 billion a month. But our guests, Joseph Stiglitz and Linda Bilmes, say those numbers don't take into account other costs spread throughout the non-military parts of the federal budget, costs that will be borne by future taxpayers, and economic damage from the war. Stiglitz and Bilmes have attempted a comprehensive accounting of the invasion's cost in a new book called The $3 Trillion War, The True Cost of the Iraq Conflict. A little later, we'll hear from Joseph Stiglitz, a Nobel Prize-winning economist. But first, Linda Bilmes. She's held several senior government positions in budget and finance, and she now teaches at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard. She's done research on the costs and challenges of treating veterans who return from the conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan. She says taxpayers will pay to treat the physical and psychological wounds of Iraq veterans for decades. Well, Linda Bilmes, welcome to Fresh Air. As you've looked at how veterans of Iraq are treated, one of the issues that you write about, besides the enormous cost borne by taxpayers and the pain that their family suffers, is the limbo that wounded servicemen and women face in the bureaucratic transition from active duty to the care of the Veterans Administration. What are some of the problems that you see there?
What you have is a situation where, for the returning veteran, there is no easy way to leave the military and to get into the Veterans Department benefits area. So you have this kind of protracted, almost second war that veterans fight when they get home. Typically, a veteran is discharged from the military. If they have a disability of some form, it takes at least 6 months for them to begin receiving any kind of compensation for that disability, even if they have a very significant wound or injury. And if there is anything wrong with the settlement, the initial decision that they have, if they have to appeal it, it takes 2 years or longer for them to get get compensation. So it's an unnecessarily long process because the veteran should be able to just quickly leave the military and move sort of seamlessly into the veterans' medical and benefit program. And in fact, they have to go through a quite protracted and complicated process.
Maybe you could illustrate this with an example. I mean, in Iraq, a vet is wounded, let's say, in an explosive device that blows up in their Humvee. I mean, they may spend time at a hospital in Germany. Take us through the journey. What path do they follow?
Well, let's say that a veteran is injured in Iraq, and he is treated initially on site. He is then medevaced to Langenthal Hospital in Germany. He is then transferred back to a military hospital in the U.S., say to Walter Reed. He maybe receives rehabilitation or treatment at two or three other facilities. When he is finally ready to be discharged from the military, if he's discharged right away, he would then lose all the benefits that he has associated with being in the military, which includes pay, it includes medical care, it includes any kind of family benefits, and he would essentially have nothing. So what happens is that veteran often is sort of hanging in limbo, languishing in an outpatient facility such as the ones that were exposed in the Walter Reed series last year, while they are effectively trying to get in to the veterans benefit compensation system. Now, the burden as it's currently structured is entirely on that veteran to prove that all of the things that he says are wrong with him actually happened. So the presumption is that those things didn't happen, and the veteran has to gather all of the documentation and all of the doctor's notices and all of the hospital forms and all of the things from all the different places, which can often take a very long time. And the system is not electronic, so you're talking about essentially a paper-based system. And for someone who comes out of a long tour of duty and an injury and often has at least some measure of post-traumatic stress disorder or at least mental disorientation, that's a very, very tall order. And it's completely unnecessary because what happens in Britain, for example, in New Zealand, in Australia, in Canada, is that the presumption is that the veteran is entitled to these benefits and the government has to prove why not. Here in the U.S., we have that sort of policy for taxes, for example. The IRS takes your tax form and then they just audit a small subset. They don't make you do all the paperwork, as it were, up front. They accept your taxes and they assume that your taxes are honest, and they audit only a subset. And what we have proposed is that we should do this for veterans. The presumption should be that what the veteran says is wrong on the basis of a medical examination when they exit.
Right.
And a subset should be audited to weed out fraud.
And when a veteran is applying for veterans benefits, suffering from whatever physical, emotional, or mental difficulties they may be that may be lingering from their combat tour, they have to rely on the Defense Department to provide information, and I gather they aren't – that sometimes they get things wrong, actually pursue people for debts they don't owe, things like that?
The military treats all people who exit the military in exactly the same way. So if you are a newly discharged soldier who has lost both legs, you get treated the same way as someone who is retiring at the end of a career. You go through the same process on exit. And as they are well aware in the Pentagon, this is a kind of non-starter for the people who are injured and they are trying to overhaul the system. But right now, the system doesn't speak, doesn't connect, doesn't work seamlessly with the Veterans Department, and it doesn't provide quickly enough for many of the veterans with injuries and disabilities all the paperwork and the materials that they need in order to very quickly receive the treatment they need on the outside.
Now, one of the features of this war, because battlefield medical treatment is so much better than it has been in years past, is that far more people survive battlefield injuries. So you have a larger stream of injured veterans coming in. And a Veterans Administration that I gather didn't exactly plan for an explosion in demand. What are some of the strains that are being placed on the Veterans Administration from physical and mental disabilities that arise from this war?
Well, the Department of Veterans Affairs has a huge capacity problem, both on the healthcare side and on the disability claims side. Now, on the healthcare side, they simply had not anticipated the huge number of troops who would be returning and seeking care. They expect that over 300,000 returning troops will be going to seek medical care from VA facilities next year. Which is about three times as many as they had anticipated. And within that, there is a particular shortage of mental health care facilities. Of the 1,400 VA medical facilities in the country, only 27 have specific post-traumatic stress disorder treatment clinics, even though we've already had over 50,000 troops come home with PTSD, diagnosed with PTSD, and over 100,000 with other mental health conditions diagnosed by the VA. So there's a real problem for just in terms of the supply of services, and this is particularly true in rural areas, in areas where the VA is just having difficulty hiring sufficient numbers of mental health professionals. On the claims side, because the Veterans Department does two things. It provides health care and it gives out disability compensation. On the claims side, there is an enormous backlog, more than 400,000 pending claims that are backed up. And the process is that a veteran has to apply to one of 57 different regional offices around the country. Some of them have claims backlogs that are going back to a year and a half long, and
put that some context on. This is like a claim for a particular a drug that they need or
no? This is if a soldier is injured in the war, when they come home after they put together their whole paperwork application, they may submit a claim for some form of financial compensation for the various medical problems that they suffer to compensate them for the fact that they can't do the job that they would have been able to do before. So let's say someone has no use for their has lost the use of their left leg, that they are now hard of hearing, and that they're vision impaired, for example. They have three problems. So And on average, a claim would cite five different problems that someone has coming home. So that claim then goes to one of these VA offices where it goes through a protracted series of analysis. They, within the Veterans Benefits Administration, will ask the veteran for additional supplementary paperwork to prove that these various problems are indeed true. And they will, at the end of it, tell the veteran that they are entitled to receive a certain amount of benefit payment. And that will be the – which comes in the form of a percentage disabled. So they would say, for example, that this person was, say, 20% disabled. And that corresponds to a monthly stipend that the veteran would receive in compensation.
And that's the kind of claim that, that there's a backlog of 400,000 of those.
Now, there's a backlog of 400,000 initial claims plus another 200,000 that are in the middle of being adjudicated. So a total backlog of 600,000. And as I said, you know, our solution to this is that all of the claims should simply be approved up front and then a subset should be audited. Because what happens now is that we put all the veterans through all of this trouble and then in the end 90% of the claims get approved anyway.
You write in the book that post-traumatic stress disorder is particularly prevalent, it seems, among vets returning from Iraq. And the mental health systems are really unable to cope with the number of vets that need care for this. What are the consequences of the failure to treat the mental disorders that vets are coming back with?
There are very significant long-term consequences, which include initially homelessness, domestic abuse, alcoholism, substance abuse, and various social problems that happen to a veteran whose post-traumatic stress disorder is not treated. Over the long term, studies of Vietnam veterans have shown that these veterans also suffer far more physical ailments, higher levels of diabetes, of heart conditions, and other long-term chronic health problems.
Your book is in part an accounting of the true costs of this war. What are all of these disorders and problems that are that go untreated or poorly treated costing taxpayers? How do you figure that out?
Well, you know, we didn't include all of the costs. I mean, for example, we did not include the cost of treating homelessness and substance abuse and domestic violence and other problems of untreated PTSD. But we just counted what it would cost to provide medical care to veterans who came back and to provide disability benefits to those who came back. And if you just look at the cost of providing disability compensation and medical care to veterans, even if we withdrew from Iraq tomorrow, even if we were not there at all, it already would double the total cost of the war. It would already be another $600 billion over the lifetime of the veterans that we would need to pay. And these are not optional. I mean, this is a these are long-term accrued liabilities. These are promissory notes. It's the kind of thing that on any sort of a business financial statement would be stated as an accrued liability.
And it is found in the budget all over the place, right, through Medicaid, through Social Security, through state and local government mental health costs?
Well, our – I mean, the cost that, that I am citing, the $600 billion in disability and medical care, that's cost primarily to the Department of Veterans Affairs and a small amount of that to the Social Security Department. Social Security disability compensation is payable to veterans who can no longer work, which would include some of the severely disabled and those with severe mental distress.
As you've looked at this problem, is there a case of a particular veteran that you think captures the tragedy of this?
Well, yes, absolutely. I mean, I've had hundreds of veterans and their families write to me over the past 2 years that I've been working on this study. And for example, the aunt of a veteran wrote to me a couple of years ago, and her nephew was in Texas. He had been he was 20 years old. He had been injured, severely injured in Iraq. He had been treated in several hospitals. He ended up at Walter Reed, where he was awarded a Purple Heart. He was visited by President Bush and a number of generals. It took him a year in the hospital to recover from very serious injuries. After that, when his aunt wrote to me, it was 18 months later, and he still had not received a penny of disability benefits, even though he could no longer even think about working as a garage mechanic, which is what he had done before. And he also was hoping to be able to retrain as a to do something in the culinary world so he could have a part-time culinary job. And he was supposed to be eligible for benefits from the Veterans Department for that, but he hadn't received any of that as well. And by the time that this story reached me, this poor kid had been trying for 18 months. They had been phoning every day. They had been writing letters. They had spoken to their congressman, and he still did not have a penny. So the mother, who had three other kids, had taken a second job, a second shift at McDonald's in their little town in Texas in order to support her son. And this story, when it came to me, and we actually told some veterans organizations about it, and he was immediately then given 18 months of retroactive pay. But why should a veteran like this, who's already been through a huge amount of trauma, and his family have to be put through this?
You end the book with some recommendations for change. What should the government do to improve the system?
There are a number of things that the government can do, particularly to improve the situation for veterans. And one of the tragedies of this is that this is not rocket science. If you spent, or any of your listeners, spent 4 hours studying the veterans' situation, you could easily find ways to make it much, much better. First of all, veterans should be automatically enrolled in the Veterans Department system when they are discharged from the military. Right now, they have to go through a long rigmarole just to be enrolled, and enrollment should be automatic. Secondly, the presumption should be shifted so that we presume that anything that a medical doctor notes at an exit medical examination is presumed to have happened to the veteran during their service. They shouldn't have to prove that the injury to their leg or the injury to their brain happened in Ramadi. It should be presumed to go with the veteran. And third of all, there should be a number of changes to enable veterans to take advantage of educational and vocational benefits to re-enter society. Right now, veterans, soldiers, when they sign up, have to pay $1,000 up front in order to qualify ever in their lives for any kind of educational benefits from the military. There's no reason why we should be charging them that money. For a lot of young 18-year-olds who sign up, that's just too much, and so they completely forfeit their chance to ever take any educational courses when they get out because they don't have the money when they sign up. There are some very basic things that we could do that would make life much, much better for those who have served their country.
Well, you just said that anyone who spent 4 hours looking at this could come up with some simple steps that would make things a lot better. And given that, you know, everybody in Washington shares respect for the sacrifice of veterans and honors them so, it would seem that this would readily have been done by now. Why is it still so flawed?
Well, the question of why it has been flawed is one of the, you know, why has more not done been done for the veterans? You know, I would say that there is an attitude which was epitomized by a statement that Defense Undersecretary David Chu made to the Wall Street Journal a couple of years ago, that the money that we're spending on the veterans essentially is money that's subtracted from money that's being spent on the defense readiness and preparedness, as if it's a kind of an either-or competition. There simply has not been a sense that the veterans deserve as much money and attention being spent on them as the troops do in the field. So I think there needs to be a cultural shift in the way the military thinks about its veterans. And there also needs to be a cultural shift in the Veterans Department away from thinking about it in terms of making sure that a veteran doesn't get one penny that he's not entitled to, toward a culture that tries to figure out how best to help the veterans when they come back. And that's simply that cultural shift has not taken place in the government to date.
Well, Linda Bilmes, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much, Dave.
Linda Bilmes teaches at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard and is co-author of The $3 Trillion War, The True Cost of the Conflict in Iraq. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. Joseph Stiglitz and Linda Bilmes have attempted an accounting of the present and future costs of the invasion of Iraq in their new book, The $3 Trillion War, The True Cost of the Iraq Conflict. Joseph Stiglitz was on the Council of Economic Advisers from 1993 to 97, serving as its chairman for 2 years. In 2001, he was awarded the Nobel Prize for Economics, and he's now on the faculty of Columbia University. I spoke to Stiglitz about some of the war's little-known costs, many of which he says will be borne by taxpayers for decades. Well, Joseph Stiglitz, welcome to Fresh Air. What does the administration estimate the war is costing or has cost?
Well, when we went to the war, the administration said it was going to cost around $50 billion. That's what we're spending now upfront in operations every 3 months. These upfront costs are only a fraction of what the war is going to cost us. There are large numbers of people being injured, disabled. We estimate about 40% of the people fighting in Iraq will suffer from disabilities. That was the experience in the Gulf War. There have been 1.6 million people in Iraq. By the time this is over, it probably will exceed 2 million. And that means in a realistic scenario, we're going to have to be paying disability payments and health care for these hundreds of thousands of returning veterans at a cost we estimate to be in excess of $600 million. So
$600 billion.
So the point is that they've only talked about the upfront cost. They've underestimated the magnitude of those upfront costs. There are a lot more cost of this war.
Now, you write in this book that the Defense Department flunked its annual audit for the 10th year running last year. I've read a lot of government's audits, and they always find some deficiencies or others. What do you mean? What's the significance of the deficiencies?
Well, these are material deficiencies. I mean, as you say, they're always little things, but the Defense Department is the only department outside the Department of Homeland, which is a new department, that has failed to meet its accounting requirements. We've passed a law saying that government departments have to be responsible. The Defense Department is the main failure in this way.
And what's wrong with its books?
Well, part of the problem is you can't figure them out. The whole point of accounting is so you know where the money is going. And there are large amounts of money that we just don't know where it's going.
Now, apart from all the difficulties of penetrating the Defense Department's budget, and you say that it's fraught with problems which auditors have found, you also say that the Bush administration's method of seeking funding for the war itself has helped to obscure its cost. Why?
Not only obscure the cost, but also make it more difficult for there to be appropriate oversight. This war has been financed by emergency appropriations. Now, in the beginning, it's perfectly understandable why you need emergency appropriations. You don't plan on a war years ahead. But 5 years into the war, we should not be using emergency appropriations to finance this conflict.
Well, let's look at some of the effects on the federal budget that are not included in the administration's specific requests for funding for the Iraq war. Now, there's a regular defense budget, which is there every year. Can you tell how much of that budget is really going to the Iraq war? How do you get an idea of that?
Well, in the last 5 years, defense budget, outside of the amounts actually explicitly appropriated for Iraq and Afghanistan, have cumulatively gone up about $500 billion. Now, we have no new enemies. We're not spending a lot of money on Star Wars programs that we hadn't previously planned on. The question is, what is this money going for? Some of it is clearly directly related to the Iraq War, the fact that we have to pay more for recruiting, we have to pay more for sign-up and reenlistment bonuses. So what we do is take a very conservative approach and say approximately a quarter of that amount is attributable to the war. Almost surely more than that, but the whole point of the way we've approached this, these calculations, is to try to take a conservative estimate because we didn't want to get into a nitpicking fight over each one of the items that makes this huge tally.
All right, so this adds up to a, in effect, hidden cost of how much?
Well, we allocate in our calculations about $125 billion to this item.
Wow.
But then there are lots of other areas of government budget that are affected. The VA, obviously, through the disability benefits, through the health care benefits, Social Security. When veterans return and they're disabled, which there are large numbers will be disabled, they can qualify for Social Security disability benefits. And so this will drain our Social Security program. So it will shows up in actually a large number of other government programs.
Many of those costs which will be borne for decades, if not generations to come, right?
Yeah. That's right.
Right.
I mean, part of the cost that's going to be borne for generations to come arise from the fact that we have financed this war through deficit. In fact, as we went to the war, we actually lowered the tax, especially on upper-income Americans. And that means that this war has entirely been financed, in a sense, by borrowing. And so as a result of that, the national debt today from the war alone is around $800 billion more than it was 5 years ago. And there's interest on this amount and there's interest on that interest, and that these amounts will just accumulate for years to come.
Now, another feature of the United States effort in Iraq has been the extensive use of private contractors, both for construction and infrastructure work, as well as significant security operations. To what extent has that driven the cost of the war up, and can you find those costs easily?
Well, you can't find these costs, and you can't find many of the other costs. I mean, one of the things that I find an outrage in a way is how difficult it was to get many of the numbers that should be publicly available. The government doesn't even disclose the full number of people being injured. They only disclose the number of people injured in hostile actions, not the total injured in Iraq. We had to use the Freedom of Information Act to actually get those numbers. Going back to the contractors, part of the problem is the contractors are expensive. The cost of a security guard can be as much as $1,000 a day. But it turns out that we not only do we pay these huge prices for these contractors, but we also pay insurance premium. And then if they get injured or killed in a hostile action, we actually wind up also paying the death benefits or the disability benefits. This is another item that doesn't show up in the Defense Department budget but shows up elsewhere in the government's cost.
And what's the scale of that spending?
That's in the billions. We provided an estimate of several billions of dollars for this. But to be fair, no one knows how high these costs really are. We took, a very conservative approach to providing a lower bound on these estimates.
Well, I wanted to talk a bit about some of the costs that are associated with the death and injuries to GIs apart from what they get in government care. Now, there is a death benefit that is paid to soldiers that are killed. What is it?
It's about $500,000.
And then you also calculate that there are losses for a soldier who dies because his family no longer has that earning capacity. How did you include that in the toll here?
Well, if an individual got injured or killed in an automobile accident, he would get compensation that's far greater than $500,000. Every day you pick up the newspaper and you see somebody lost a leg and they got a jury verdict of $6 million, $7 million. The government has a systematic approach to valuing life, to valuing injury. It's called the value of statistical life.
That's value of statistical life, you say?
That's right. Yeah. It's the value of statistical life in the case of somebody who has lost their life. There is a similar concept for an injury. When the government comes to evaluate whether to have a regulation, a safety regulation, environmental regulation, it tries to assess the cost of the regulation versus the benefit, and the benefit is assessed in terms of the number of lives that will be saved, and then they look at the value of these lives. And the number they typically use is in the order of magnitude of $7 to $8 million per life. That's much larger than the $500,000 that shows up in the cost to the government in its budget.
And if I understand, if I can just understand what you're saying that in certain cases where the government is doing cost benefits analysis, the cost of a death caused by, say, environmental pollution would be valued at $7 million. But a GI who dies gets a flat $500,000. Am I hearing you right?
You are hearing me right. And so what we point out that there's a big discrepancy, and we ought to be counting that discrepancy as part of the cost of the war.
You also look at the effects of the war on the economy in the United States and nationally and conclude that conservatively there's a $187 million cost on the U.S. economy. This is very complex stuff, but in a nutshell, how do you figure that out?
Well, there are several parts of the cost to our macroeconomy, to our aggregate economy. The first part is the fact that the war has led to higher oil prices. When we went to the war, the cost of oil, it's hard to remember, the cost of oil was $25 a barrel. Now it's just reached $100 a barrel. The futures markets realized that there would be increased demands from China, from developing countries, but they expected that there would be a corresponding increase in supply, ample supplies from the Middle East at low cost, and that the price would remain for the next decade around $25 a barrel. The war changed that equation. In our estimates, we are very conservative, and we say only $5 of the increase of the price of oil since the beginning of the war is attributable to the war. In our more moderate, more realistic estimate, it's $10. I think realistically, it's actually much higher than that.
That's per barrel, right.
That's per barrel.
Right.
And in our very conservative estimate, we say that the price increase will only last for 7 years. The market is expecting these price increases to last at least through 2015. So the fact is that the high price of oil, which the war brought out, has a strong cost to the economy. Americans are spending money importing oil. Money is going to Saudi Arabia and other oil-producing countries. And that means that not only are we shipping money abroad, the money doesn't have the multiplier effects that it would have had it been spent here at home. And the much more realistic number is a number that is much larger than a number in excess of $300 billion. That's just the first cost. There's a second set of costs that related to the fact that money spent in Iraq itself doesn't stimulate the economy in the way that money spent at home would have spent. If you spend money on an Iraqi contractor or a Naples contractor working in Iraq, it doesn't have the second, third round effects that we would have spent, say, on building a road or an education here at home. So that, too, depresses the economy. Thirdly, if we had spent the money on investments in the United States, it would have led to longer-term economic growth. And fourthly, because we borrow so much, as mentioned before, we funded this war by borrowing, there is a huge increase in our debt, and that too exerts a negative effect on our economy. And when you include all of these, you get a picture of a macroeconomic cost that is well in excess of a $1 trillion.
You know, I mean, the economy is so vast and complicated and has so many hundreds of interconnected and moving parts. I mean, that's one of the reasons that economists disagree, it seems to me, about just the impact of just about everything. But I'm wondering, and I realize I'm talking to a Nobel Prize winning economist here, but how you can be confident of an analysis in which, you know, the interactions are so complex. I mean, for example, I mean, should you not subtract the stimulus effect of this stream of payments, I mean, however dreadful they are, to injured veterans and people on Social Security disagreement? I mean, isn't there a spending multiplier as those dollars ripple through the American economy?
Well, that's why we were very conservative in our approach. We recognized that those dollars would have an effect. So when we looked at a comparison between what happened to the money spent on Iraq and other forms of expenditure, we only assumed a fraction of that money was spent actually in Iraq. The rest of the money that you talked about that would be spent by our disabled people, that we treated just like any other kind of expenditure. So we were fairly careful to take what you said into account. Actually, the mystery as we were writing the book was, given how strong our analysis, and I think this is an analysis that I think that most people would have accepted, how strong the negative effects of the war should have been on the economy, why didn't the economy seem weaker than it was? And the answer that we came to was that we were living on borrowed money, that easy money from the Fed, lax regulation from government regulators enabled people to take out hundreds of billions of dollars out of their houses, what we call mortgage equity withdrawals, and the hundreds of billions of dollars, a housing bubble. All of that clouded over, hid these negative effects. But because we were living on borrowed money and borrowed time, a day of reckoning had to come, and now it has come.
Well, Joseph Stiglitz, the cost that you described seems so gargantuan, so enduring, and the damage to the economy you described seems so almost catastrophic. I mean, what havoc have we reaped on the nation? How bad is this?
Well, we're a rich country. We can, in some sense, afford it. If we were a poor country, it would have raked enormous havoc. But $3 trillion we can afford. But you have to ask the question, what is the opportunity cost? What could we have done with that $3 trillion? Could we have spent the money in ways that would leave our economy stronger, our society more secure, the war against terrorism, the war for democracy in a better position? I think when you ask questions that way, you have to say, no, this money was not well spent. Just to take one example, in Africa, we're worried about the increasing presence of China. We're spending $5 billion a year in Africa. That's roughly 10 days fighting. If we include the full-on cost, including the cost of disability, we're talking about 5 days fighting is what we are contributing to help the poorest continent in the world. For a fraction of what we are spending in Iraq, we could have repaired our Social Security system for the next 50, 75 years, put it on sound financial footing. So if you start listing all the problems our society faces, you realize that we have a new metric, a new way of thinking about it. What fraction of what we have spent in the Iraq War would solving this particular problem have cost? And when you start thinking that way, you realize that this war has cost us a great deal.
Well, Joseph Stiglitz, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Joseph Stiglitz is co-author with Linda Bilmes of The $3 Trillion War, The True Cost of the Iraq Conflict. The Drive-By Truckers is a southern rock band led by Patterson Hood and Mike Cooley, both of whom have impressive pedigrees. Hood is the son of the bassist for the famous Muscle Shoals Rhythm Section, which played many classic Atlantic Records soul songs in the 1960s. Mike Cooley is the grandson of Western swing fiddler Spade Cooley. Over the past decade, however, Hood, Cooley, and the Drive-By Truckers have developed their own legacy of detailed, complex songs in albums such as 2001's Southern Rock Opera. Rock critic Ken Tucker says the Truckers' new album, Brighter Than Creation's Dark, is one of their best written and most enjoyable yet.
That's Patterson Hood, delineating the limits and pleasures of a working-class existence. His band, the Drive-By Truckers, seems to feel more of an affinity for this theme than most rock bands in this new century. At a time when the notion of regionalism in pop music has all but disappeared everywhere except in hip-hop, this mixture of Southern soul, British invasion rock, and Texas honky-tonk is especially welcome. It was a straight shot. All it took was luck to not get caught. I laid three dimes down and the machine wanted 25 cents. In the backseat, her and a friend, one out the window and the other on the other end. One bad loop away from Sunday night's news. Although bass player Shauna Tucker contributes a few songs sung in a honey-baked croon, it's Patterson and Hood who continue to write the Class A material, often alternating songs on this 19-song CD. They've divided up the track listings as though it was a double album on vinyl. 5 songs on sides 1, 2, and 3, 4 songs on the so-called side 4. Does this affectation mean anything beyond nostalgia? I'm not sure. And not being sure is one way artists keep audiences under their spell, off balance, ready to be surprised for whatever may come next. You've become such a mess. You and your crystal meth. You lost your family, wrecked your truck. I used to love you, now you suck. We were friends among the best. You and your crystal meth. Ain't exactly a no-drug guy. Don't dig the way that you get high. Hope your kids don't see you throwing up. Hope they ain't there if the house blows up. Hope you ain't murdered in your sleep. Up all night with that cranked out creep. You ain't eaten, you ain't slept. You and your crystal meth. Now there's an anti-drug song for you, as plain-spoken yet not preachy as any kind of listener could want. Patterson Hood's eerie-sounding merge of vocal and keyboard result in a freaky nightmare scenario. These guys are very good at what would, in lesser throats, be message songs. Take Hood's portrait of a woman whose husband or boyfriend is in an overseas war for no good reason that she can figure out. Once again, such songs are only as good as the music that surrounds them. The Drive-By Truckers have enlisted Spooner Oldham as their keyboardist. He played on Wilson Pickett's Mustang Sally and Percy Sledge's When a Man Loves a Woman and co-wrote The Box Tops' Cry Like a Baby, among many others. When a trusty soul like Oldham has your back, it must make you more confident when you're reaching for your more novelistic touches. Bloody nose. Empty pockets, a rented car, the trunk full of guns. It ain't true that the sun don't rise in Vegas. I seen it once. She might have been somebody's mama. He might have been
somebody some. But if the sun went down on them that night in Vegas, their luck was good as gone.
Over the course of Brighter Than Creation's Dark, there's a lot of talk about lousy jobs, struggling families, and cherished children, contrasted with painful isolation. The music the band has found to drive home these diverse subjects suits its attractive lack of self-absorption. Thick, muscular rock, country, and R&B. When in one of their songs they quote Bob Seger's phrase, "Rock and roll never forgets," their melodies and their drawled phrasing confirms that they have a long memory that can be both the source of great pain and great comfort.
Ken Tucker is editor-at-large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Brighter Than Creation's Dark by the Drive-By Truckers. You can download podcasts of the show at freshair.npr.org.